Good morning, everybody. Let's see if we can get this thing here started so y'all can get out to lunch before you get too hungry. I'd like to introduce our panelists for this morning. First, so we have academic credibility, to my far left is Charles Tabb, a chaired professor of law at the University of Illinois Law School. He is, this term, the scholar-in-residence for the ABI, which means he is in Washington. It also means, bless his heart, he does not have to read final exams this term. I remember years ago talking to Professor Larry King, the late great scholar on bankruptcy, and Larry said he twice a year became physically ill at the thought of having to grade final exams. The professor, as you can imagine, is a Phi Bate from Vanderbilt, good old Southern boy, and Order of Coif from University of Virginia. Just to be sure that we're not too boring, sitting to my immediately left is Lou Phillips from the firm Gordon Arata in Baton Rouge. Now, I remember the first time I heard someone say the firm name Gordon Arata. This was, as I said, spoken, not written. And so I didn't know how it was spelled. So I thought, Arata, does that come from the Greek word meaning, like errata or erratum, meaning mistake? And I thought, you know, for a law firm whose name is somebody or other mistake, it doesn't make much sense. But then I thought, what the hell, that's Louisiana. Then I thought, errata. Maybe it comes from the word eros, as in erotic. And then I thought, yeah, that's got to be it, because the firm's largest office is in New Orleans, where everything goes. I was disappointed when I saw the firm name spelled, and it's actually spelled A-R-A-T-A. Lou also gives us academic credibility, because ever since the flood, which I think is in the late 80s, you shouldn't, when you're talking about Louisiana, you shouldn't say the flood, because that may actually mean something, and I'm as in order to thinking of it in terms of biblical terms. But Lou has been teaching the bankruptcy course at LSU ever since 1988, which is about the time he started becoming a bankruptcy judge. He did that for a full term, and now he has gone on to the real world of lawyering. I'm just a little old bankruptcy reporter, so I don't hardly much matter. Today, we're going to give you about 15 very recent cases, two of them decided just this week. This is a pretty aggressive schedule. We'll try to move through all of these if we possibly can. Because this is an hour and a half session, for those of you who have put too much coffee on top of your large prostates, we will allow you to get up if you leave, want to, and do something. If, however, you need to get up, but you actually need to make a telephone call, just say so, and we'll know what the real purpose was.
What about the females?
You know, I've...
They don't have prostates.
Well, if I were female, I would not have gone through what I went through about 3 months ago, but we'll leave it at that. let's start off, as we must, with the United States Supreme Court, with the case Law versus Siegel, which was decided on the 5th of March. In my judgment, this is an opinion by Justice Scalia, which marks the beginning of the end of bankruptcy courts as courts of equity. This case presented the best possible facts there could be for a ruling the direct opposite of what Justice Scalia said in his opinion. In this case, there was an individual bankrupt who committed numerous frauds in trying to hide property from his trustee and his creditors. The trustee ended up spending about $500,000 chasing these fraudulent transfers and could recover nothing. To defray the huge administrative expense, the bankruptcy judge allowed the trustee, in effect, to void the man's exemption on his home to recover about $75,000. That's what was done in the bankruptcy and the circuit courts, only to be reversed in the United States Supreme Court, as I said, in a unanimous opinion by Justice Scalia. The problem with the lower court was they were flying in the face of Section 552K of the Bankruptcy Code, which, as you recall, says that exempt property may not be used to pay expenses of administration. As I said, there was could not be a better set of facts where you could evade somebody's exempt property to recover estate expenses. But Justice Scalia said we must adhere strictly to the language of the statute, 552K, and we cannot use, in those circumstances, the All Writs Act in Section 105 to do what the statute says we may not do. It strikes me that this is a case, and I wonder if anybody agrees or disagrees with the proposition, that Congress simply did not contemplate when it wrote the statute. I think it was writing the statute to mean that in an ordinary case, exempt property cannot be used to defray expenses of administration, but I really sincerely doubt that Congress was thinking about cases of abject fraud. But this is where we are now. Courts cannot use their brains. They have to reflexively follow a statute, even if it makes no damn sense in the particular case.
When can we disagree with you? No. What'll be interesting, and of course this is a business case law session, so you're all wondering, you know, why we're talking about an exemption case. Obviously, the interesting question is going to be the use of the equity powers of the court to elaborate on the statute, as you will. So I think where we're going to be seeing the action is in trying to figure out where the exact line is. And I actually think that the limit that's going to be put on bankruptcy judges in terms of how they'll see it is essentially non-existent compared to the way it was before. Because if you look at the opinion, both what the facts were, what the law was they were dealing with, and what Scalia said, it's only when there's an express command. And the problem in the case is the worst possible facts, because 522K says exactly that you cannot do the exact thing the bankruptcy court did in the case. Nothing else is specifically excluded from the range of what a court can do. So you look at things like critical vendor orders, things like that. I don't know what's going to happen to those, but I don't think they'll change. Maybe third-party releases will be a little dicier, but I don't think it's going to actually end up making all that dramatic a change.
Yeah, I agree with respect to the business stamp, the business perspective. I know this is business, but one of the things that we represent a lot of trustees, and one of the things that we find and the court, I think, overruled was the bankruptcy court's authority to preclude the assertion of an exemption, say, late. You don't have property, you don't disclose property, because the case is included in the reversal. Or the court doesn't have the power to do this, included were cases that provided that if the claimant of exemption late for property that wasn't scheduled upon discovery by the trustee is somehow prejudicial or somehow in bad faith, you can't make the claim. That's something that I think is a problem. The other thing that I've been thinking about, one of the things that I found most useful on the bench was the use of civil contempt power. If an order to turn over property to the state was not complied with, we had a very elaborate process that I confected along with the United States Attorney to issue an order to show cause why you shouldn't be held in contempt. If they didn't show up, which they never did, you issue an order of contempt and give them 5 days to appear, and they didn't appear. And then I'd go get the marshal to go arrest them and bring them into the courtroom, and I'd say, you were ordered to turn over property of a value of X. You didn't come in and contest it. The order was entered. You're found in contempt. You're going over next door to the jail till you pay. until
I think John Olson really took a page out of your book with the number of people he sent to jail.
Well, the to the one, they said, well, if I'm in jail, I can't pay. And my response was, I've done this a lot of times. No one died in jail, and no one's in jail now. So my bet is you'll pay, and they all pay. But one of the ways you can get out is you can get out and you can say, I don't have any way to pay. And they all told me that, but I didn't believe them. And none of them tried to prove it. But one of the things that the cases use to analyze whether or not you can ever pay or you're just being held in jail for criminal contempt, which a bankruptcy court doesn't have the authority to do, is show me your assets, including your exempt assets. And if you have exempt assets, then you have assets with which to pay, and you can't get out of a civil contempt sanction. I don't know what happens here with that.
Of course, they can still choose to use their exempt assets to get out of jail. You can't make them.
No, I can't make them, but they stay. And, but anyway, I agree with Charles that I don't think this is going to be a big – I'm not the doom and gloom that Bill is. I don't think it's going to be a big eradication of equity power of the court.
Well, listen, Lou, while your microphone is hot, why don't you talk to us about Clark versus Ramaker?
Another non-business case, but it's up before the Supreme Court.
And I argued on the 24th of March.
I kept telling these guys, you know, we're in the business case, and they said, we're doing these. So I was outvoted 2-1. Clark versus Ramaker, the split in the circuits, 5th and 7th, about an inherited IRA and whether it's subject to a claim of exemption under 522D12. It's not a state law question, a state law exemption question. It's a federal exemption, 522D12. The Seventh Circuit says that it is not exempt because the requirements of 522D12 are two. A, the funds must be retirement funds held in an account. And then B, they must not be subject to taxation under a list of IRS sections. The Fifth Circuit case in Chilton said that the funds were retirement funds because they started out as retirement funds. The person who collected the retirement funds died and did what was necessary to do to transfer those funds under 402 of the Internal Revenue Code to a qualified IRA account that is a rollover for purposes of taxation, but is not a rollover for purposes of the transferee being able to maintain the fund as an IRA. There are specific rules. You have to start paying out within a year or pay out everything within 5, generally speaking. And the lower court in Chilton said that let's assume they're retirement funds. We're not going to dispute that. This account is not exempted from taxation under 408 of the Internal Revenue Code, which is one of the listed exceptions from taxation section, but rather 402, which tells you how to move money from an IRA into an inherited IRA status. The Fifth Circuit reversed and said, number one, they are retirement funds because they started out that way, and number two, they are taxed under 408 because, and here's where it gets a little funny, because they're taxed under 408. And the Seventh Circuit, in saying that the inherited IRA is not exempt, didn't focus on the statute under which the account is taxed. It focused on what is the definition of retirement funds. Mm-hmm. Retirement funds is not defined in the bankruptcy code, and what Judge Easterbrook said was that these weren't retirement funds because once you have an inherited IRA, they're definitely not held for retirement of the debtor.
Let me tell you the way I see this case coming down. The Fifth Circuit said they didn't really like the way they had to rule, but they said this is a plain meaning case. The statutory definitions in the IRS code, the bankruptcy code together, demand this result. The Seventh Circuit is the most independent there is. when it comes to departing from the language of the statute. And Easterbrook's opinion, in my view, is nothing more than a perfect example of the Seventh Circuit using the Chicago theory of economics to decide cases. And he said this is disposable income, ergo, it's not a retirement fund. And I can't wait to see how Scalia comes down on this.
Well, I don't think Scalia would have any trouble if he wanted to uphold the Seventh Circuit, though, because just say it's not retirement funds, which that's not contravening plain meaning because they're not retirement funds now.
And retirement funds is not defined in the statute. Yeah. So I think you could I thought that the analysis of the bankruptcy judge in Chilton, which found that it was not exempt, which focused on the section of the IRS Internal Revenue Code under which this transaction is taxed, was interesting mm-hmm. because it said, you know, it's set up under this subsection 402. 402 is not in 522 D12, but the Fifth Circuit said, well, it's still taxed. The distributions are taxed as per 408. So yeah. I don't know what's going on.
Well, Bob Martin had a good opinion yeah. in the Seventh Circuit.
Well, yeah. she followed him.
Yeah. yeah. yeah.
By the way, speaking of, we don't know how it's going to go, we're not going to talk about the Stern versus Marshall case, executive benefits versus Arkansas. But I guarantee you, it's going to be 5-4. That's for sure. I predict that. I just don't know which way it's going to go.
I think it depends on how Alito votes.
Precisely. He was flopping back and forth like a madman during oral argument. So Lord knows how it comes down. Let's do a couple of new cases. First, we got Meridian Sunrise Village from way out in Washington State. Charles, tell us about that.
Well, this case is one of the ones Bill dug up for us. It's hard preparing for this because you think you're ready, and then Bill says, I got another case,
like
including one I was reading on the plane yesterday that I got in the lounge waiting. So how about this case? We'll get to that one in a minute. But this case was decided on March 6th. At first blush, it sounds either terrifying or thrilling because a hedge fund had its vote disallowed in a Chapter 11.
Yeah, just because it's a hedge fund. Couldn't happen to nicer people.
So you can see which side of the street Bill walks on here with this.
Well, I got to be careful because I'm from New York, and now people, you know, my customers are all.
I was going to say Bloomberg essentially has something.
I would
hedge funds.
I would never say this in a panel up north.
Yeah, we'll hold you to it. But it may not really be as dramatic a case as it appears because what actually happened, the debtor and their lender had a. Hey, negotiated this loan, of course, and there was a definition of eligible assignees that he carefully had negotiated. This was a key part of the whole loan package, and it was limited to financial institutions and people like that. When the court took to trying to dig a little deeper to interpret what eligible assignees meant, it was quite clear that what the debtor had in mind and what the lender fully understood is they did not want the loan to be able to be assigned to a distressed debt hedge fund, the exact people ended up being assigned to. They had tried to work something out, and ultimately, of course, that ended up not happening. Once the lender went ahead and started to charge them the default rate of interest, debtor then files the 11, at which point, the lender assigns the claim to, what's the name here, just to see if we can get a flavor of this, NB Distressed Debt Investment Fund Limited, which the debtor then objected to their vote, said they're not an eligible assignee pretty clearly. The court agreed with the debtor and basically just, it was a contract interpretation case basically, and said, they're not an eligible assignee, so they were not taking the claim here. So I don't think it's that dramatic, but it is fun to be able to say there's a case where hedge funds got hosed. Yeah.
Got hosed, yeah. But one of the things that was really interesting about reading this little opinion is the district court defined the funds as funds who engage in purchasing distressed debt and predatory lending practice. And so he only, the judge only mentioned that about seven times in the opinion. And you kind of got a flavor in the introductory phrase. This is what this fund
does. Wasn't hard to see how
this
was going to come out, yeah.
The use of predatory in every paragraph gave it pretty good flavor. The judge must have, I don't know. Anyway, but one of the things that's important is if you look at the case and you are you represent borrowers and the lenders, you know, up front, it might be worth it to try to see what you can get as far as limitations on assignment, if that's even interesting to you.
Yeah.
The problem, of course, when you have the distressed debt purchase is that the bank has just cleaned itself out and is not going to have to deal within a regulatory scheme to deal with you, and the people who have the skin in the game now don't have much.
Right.
By the way, did this opinion say anything about whether or not the claim would be allowed?
No, it didn't, and that was my question. Yeah. You stole my question to you. I'm the one that sent that question to him.
I didn't want to have to answer it. That's the reason I gave it to you.
Why just not go the next step if you're not an eligible assignee, rather than just having your vote thrown out? Can you have a claim? I mean, can you be an assignee if you're not an eligible assignee? The loan agreement didn't say that to be an eligible assignee to vote on a plan of reorganization when I file bankruptcy after I go into default on this debt. It said you can't assign the damn loan.
At all.
Yeah. So I'm thinking that the hedge fund has even worse problems under that contract.
Yeah, they might have to sell the loan and probably at a loss.
Yeah.
Got to be careful.
Well, I don't have a claim, so let me sell it.
Lou, your microphone's hot. Let's go on to the next new case, that is to say LCI Holdings.
Yeah, that was one that I got as they were telling us to turn off our phones on the airplane.
We must have been flying about the same time.
Yeah, we were, because you're saying
I downloaded it, I said I'm getting on a plane.
And I couldn't even say I was getting on a plane because I was on the plane. Here you have a Chapter 11 case. It's a case out of Delaware, and the debtor comes in to court with pants on fire. I've got to sell the assets of the company to the lender in 3 weeks, which doesn't sound all that unusual for Delaware, but I'm from Louisiana, and so we lose. If you have a case that's got over $67,000 in debt in Louisiana, it moves to Delaware, so we're a little pissed about that. I know nobody here has ever experienced anything like that, watching the case fly away. But and so what happened was a committee got formed, and the government had a debt of $168 million. This is the different one. LCI had come in.
You're combining
yeah,
cases.
Yeah, I'm combining cases. The lender wants to buy the deal, and the deal is, no, I'm combining cases,
right?
I'm combining cases. LCI sale that sets out a gifting program whereby the lender takes the assets and sets aside $3.5 million for unsecured claims, some for subordinated debt, and some for the subordinated debt and unsecured creditors' lawyers.
Yep.
The IRS opposes it. And
so they weren't included in the largesse.
And in fact, the IRS says we have a claim that primes these other claimants who are getting paid.
Yeah, they had an administrative claim.
Yeah, they had an
administrative claim.
And so you've got unsecured debt and sub-debt that are getting paid, and we're not.
Oh, and by the way, just to be sure nobody gets anything except these special people, the bankruptcy judge ruled that once this appeal was over with, the case is going to be dismissed.
Correct.
So it's lights out for everybody else.
So it's a Chapter 11 case. The case is going to be dismissed after the sale closes, and the government says you can't do this. Now, one of the analysis of whether a sale is good, of course, business purpose, But also, there's just a ream of cases that incorporate, to some extent, the fair and equitable requirement. In other words, you can't circumvent a Chapter 11 case, fair and equitable rule, through use of Section 363 sales. And what the court here said was that the case had a business purpose, the sale had a business purpose, and the property that was being paid to the unsecured creditors, the sub-debt holder, and the creditor's lawyer was not property of the debtor, it was property of the purchaser. And there also involved a settlement, and the settlement was part of this holdout. So the question is, number one, if you're the IRS, what happens? Well, they got beat, and the subsequent case, the subsequent history of the case is they attempted to appeal, get an interlocutory appeal. The district court denied it. But anyway, you can't get relief, and you can gift your money because it's not property of the estate, and we're only doing a sale so we don't have a cram down, and it's a Chapter 11 that's going to dispose of all the assets, and once that's done, we're going to get the case dismissed.
The linchpin to the opinion is the district judge, Sue Robinson in Delaware, said that she was in essence bound by the findings of fact by the bankruptcy judge that the property that went, that leaped over all of the priorities, was not property of the estate. It is very possible that the reason this appeal went off this way is because the IRS did a lousy job of making a record in the bankruptcy court.
This is an important issue, and this is one that just keeps recurring. I mean, the same sort of argument has been made from time immemorial. I mean, this is the argument that was made back in the railroad cases in the late 19th, early 20th century. It's not anybody else's property. It's my property. I'm the one coming in to buy. I can say who gets my money. And I pick this person, not you. I pick you. And in one flavor or another, whenever it goes all the way up, like, you know, go back to Northern Railway and Boyd, they're like, come on. Like, that's silly. You can't do that. But, I mean, we saw this same general concept happened in the auto cases, right? I mean, they said, well, it's not property that anybody else has an interest in. I mean, if the purchaser says, hey, I think the union should get more or whatever, have fun, you know? And so it's really a fundamental issue, but if this works, this is a heck of a thing.
I represented a trustee before, and this was it was a business case where a bank had committed a tortious act in sequestering property, a corporate property, and I was brought in. There was an involuntary file by the creditors of the company because the settlement by the company and the shareholders who had been viciously damaged as well. Provided that 100% of the settlement proceeds would be paid to the shareholders and none to the company. And the company made the decision, had about four shareholders, they were getting $1.5 million, and the company made the decision that it's really the shareholders' claim and not ours, and the bank said we need to pay for their release, and so involuntary was filed. Trustee was appointed, I represented the trustee, and I said, no, that's the company's money. You can go out and pay anybody you want to, but I've still got the claim. Mm-hmm. And here it's hard for me to see how you can say asset pool is going to purchaser, but purchaser's purchase price for asset pool gets to be directed by purchaser. I mean, why would purchaser care?
Yeah, right.
Well, purchaser care that the sub debt of some $100 million gets $2 million?
Well, it's because of who owns the sub debt. I'm going to tell you, I'm not really upset about this result.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the matter with him?
Oh, here's.
He's upset about that.
He's just trying to make it up to the New York people.
Well,
like,
because what I'm seeing among the judges in Delaware and New York is they do not like these quickie prepack sales worth a damn. come into court. Within 6 weeks, the whole thing is sold, and typically the unsecured creditors are completely out of underwater, would get nothing in even in a liquidating plan. The judges believe there's something wrong with this because they think, I believe they think, that a secured creditor through bankruptcy has got more rights than the secured creditor would have in a UCC foreclosure. And therefore, they are hell-bent in Delaware in insisting that there be something for other creditors in these underwater cases where the liens exceed the assets. And they are allowing this to happen, and I believe they will continue to allow it to happen, until the Reform Commission convinces Congress we've got to do something about 363 sales for those people who believe that a sale in bankruptcy confers greater value than secured lenders have under the UCC. So there.
But I'm with Charles. I just don't know how you can I just don't know how you can say that the purchase price is not property of the estate.
We pause this program for your online CLE codes. Please write down 28472. Thank you.
I just don't know how you can say
well, also,
that it's
but yeah, and I agree, because what the committee is trading on when they get these settlements is an avoidance theory. The avoidance action belongs to the estate. It's money paid in return for an avoidance. Well, I don't – look, we got to go on because we should do a whole show on that. Let's go to the Third Circuit, KB Toys, from November. The circuit did a mitzvah because they disagreed with a 2007 opinion by District Judge Shira Shindlin in New York. The question was this. If a creditor sells the claim to a third party, a typical claim buyer, then the debtor turns around and sues that original claim holder for a preference, does or does not 502D apply so that the claim purchaser cannot receive a distribution on the claim until there is a payment of the preference?
Which is not going to happen because that party had gone out of business.
Precisely. So Shira Shindlin, in the case 7 years ago, said basically that once you sell the claim, you have cleansed it, and the claim purchaser is immune from a Section 502D disallowance. Well, that was the law, considered to be the law, until the Third Circuit got a hold of it in November in a decision by Circuit Judge Patty Schwartz. She said, hell no. What she did was she looked back, believe this or not, to a 19-2 case under Section 57G of the Bankruptcy Code. She also, or Bankruptcy Act, that is. She also looked at legislative history, and she said that the focus is on the claim, right, not on the claim holder. And so, therefore, the purchase of the claim is just out of luck and will receive no distribution until that preference is paid. What this means is it will require purchasers of claims to have more creditworthy sellers of the claims so they can put these claims back to them successfully when there is a disallowance.
Works for me.
Well, how about that?
I think that's right. I go back to the – and this probably is not right, but I started thinking – about the case, the name of which I've forgotten, where there was a fraud claim that was settled and turned into a judgment and a note, or a note and a judgment, or consent.
Archer versus Horner.
Yeah. And the Supreme Court says that the claim retained,
right,
the note retained the original, it was still the same claim. Now, there you didn't have a transfer of the claim, but the 502D says that the court shall disallow any claim of any entity. And then I think this is nothing more than a holding that the claim is still the claim,
right,
of the original,
right,
entity.
Right.
It was purchased by an assignee of the,
right,
claim. And so I'm not bothered by it.
Nor I.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to the international sphere. Professor Charles is a maven on Chapter 15. We happen to have three really good ones.
I'm actually going to talk about four, so I figure I got 90 seconds of shot there. A lot has been happening in Chapter 15, and it's interesting. I think a theme throughout a lot of the cases that have been coming up is raising questions about how faithful the U.S. courts are being to what's going on there. The first case I wanted to flag for you, which is pretty significant, is the Barnett case out of the Second Circuit, 737 F. 3rd 238, decided in December. What that case held is that to qualify as a debtor under Chapter 15, you also have to meet the Section 109A eligible for a debtor requirements, which includes a connection to the United States for a foreign debtor. The only one that's likely to be possible is property. Now, I know you don't have to have a lot of property, but there can be cases, as this case was, a case out of Australia, where the debtor doesn't have any property in the United States. What they needed to do was do discovery in the United States, because several hundred million dollars had apparently found its way fraudulently or allegedly into the hands of someone in the United States. And so the Australian liquidator wanted to try and track that down. And with the holding in Barnett, they can't, because they can't get the debtor qualified under Chapter 15. The court struggled with the statutory language. It's one of those it'll make your head spin around like The Exorcist if you actually try and work through all the statutory sections, and I don't want to do that. I think it has to be the wrong outcome. The statute is tough to get around. There are some things that are hard to explain, but just note that case, the Barnett case. The next thing I wanted to flag for you, I think, is a fairly significant development as well. It's not a new development. But it's sort of highlighted first by not a brand new case, one I think any of you that have done any look in this area know well, of course, is the Vitro case out of the Fifth Circuit. And I want to couple that with the Kimonda case, which the current name of that, it's Jaffe versus Samsung Electrics Company Limited, was decided December 3rd. Out of the Fourth Circuit, 737 F. 3rd 14. And what these cases have to do with is the extent that when you have a legitimate, clearly a foreign proceeding, obviously in the Vitro case, you had a Mexican concurso where they had approved third-party releases. And the Fifth Circuit says, yeah, no way we're going to enforce that here, even though we're going to recognize your case. We don't like that kind of law. Plus, we think you're a bunch of crooks down there. They didn't say that, but that's the subtext everybody talks about. And then the Jaffe case, which has been known, it's been up and down, as the Kimonda case, has to do with the intellectual property licenses. And what the deal was in that case, the German case, and under the German law is like our law was before Congress woke up after Lubrizol was decided and said, well, that's not very fair, and does not let the debtor simply cancel licenses and take the licensed property away from the licensees. German law says, fine, you can do that. Well, they had Kimonda, like 4,000 of their licenses were with U.S. licensees, and Jaffe, the administrator, wanted to cancel the licenses. So the big issue in that case is, well, do we have to defer to the German law, which says you can do that, or are we going to apply some combination of U.S. law and find a loophole in Chapter 15 to get out from under it? In very much the same way that the Fifth Circuit in Vitro had said we're not going to enforce it, they came out the same way. They did not, in the Jaffe case, ultimately decide on the public policy exception. The way they really got at it was saying under 1522, you have to do sufficient protection for creditors. And they say, well, if you're going to cancel the U.S. licensee's interest, they're not being sufficiently protected. So that's an ongoing development. And then the final one I just wanted to mention is the Fairfield Sentry case. Now, many of you probably know, of course, that Fairfield was one of the biggest, maybe even the biggest, Madoff feeder fund. And so, they're incorporated in the BVI, but everything they did was, of course, really in the U.S. Question there, again, went up to the Second Circuit, was where the center of main interest was, whether we're going to basically acknowledge the liquidation proceeding in the BVI as a foreign main proceeding and give it effect in the United States. One might have wondered after the Bear Stearns case, which many of you know about, maybe they wouldn't have.
Who wrote in bankruptcy court, who wrote Bear Stearns?
And oh,
who
yeah. Wrote, Burton, the late, great Burton Liflin, of course, wrote Bear Stearns and also wrote opinion in Fairfield. What was relevant about Fairfield,
which is not insignificant because Burt was one of the draftsmen of the revised statute.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what he really went off on and what they went off on in the Fairfield case, a couple thoughts. You determine Comey as of the time of the Chapter 15 petition. In other words, you don't look back at the operational history, which is, in fact, consistent with a prior case out of the Fifth Circuit, the Ron case, Lobby versus Ron, a case where a guy did all sorts of nefarious things in Israel and then moved to the United States. Finally, the Israeli receiver tried to catch up with him in the United States. And they said, well, sorry, you're not a main proceeding because he lives here in the United States now. So we have to look at now and not then. But they did find that the BVI was the Comey because that's where the liquidation was happening, which was the only thing happening now.
Yeah, how long had the liquidation gone on in the BVI, 6 months, a year or something?
A year and a half, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. A long time.
Yeah. Well, so that's what I got.
Professor, you're on a roll. So why don't you continue and talk about the earth-shaking events in Fisker, the defunct electric car
maker. Yeah, of course, this is a case I suspect anyone who bothered to wander into the business case law update session probably doesn't even need us to talk about the Fisker case. You, I'm sure, feel strongly one way or the other. This is the case in which Judge Gross capped credit bidding.
Delaware case again.
Delaware case capped credit bidding. I mean, how awesome is that? Which, you know, it had looked like, given the run of the case law and Radlax and everything, that the credit bid right was sacrosanct. However, of course, as Radlax in many cases had said, you have the for-cause exception in 363K, right? And so, the question of the hour is, well, what constitutes cause? What had happened in the Fisker case, and this is one you wanted to talk about earlier. So this is where we had the $168 million loan was purchased for $25 million. And the buyer wanted to credit bid, and they're going to credit bid 75 of their, what they said, their $168 million claim. Problem was there was another potential purchaser who was willing to put up actual money in a fair bit, but they weren't going to go to $168 million.
Oh, by the way, let's add that Fisker came dancing into bankruptcy court saying we want to sell this thing within about 2 or 3 weeks of bankruptcy, no auction, no
private
auction, because there's no other conceivable buyer.
Right, and of course the creditors committee is saying, well, how about these guys that will pay like $143 million or whatever, say, no, I don't see any conceivable buyers here. So we just have to do quick, down and dirty, private sale, allow them to credit bid. Also a little tricky because it's unclear what the exact amount of the secured claim would have been. That, and indeed the opinion doesn't settle that. It just says it's contested. So one thing to note in terms of what's the precedential reach of Fisker is not clear if it had indisputably been secured, say even up to the 168. Well, what would they have said about that? But anyway, what Judge Gross did is he capped the credit bid at the amount for which it was purchased. Said hybrid, you can credit bid up to $25 million. But not beyond that because there's cause. Cause because One, you bought it for just $25 million. Two, is not only going to chill the auction, there will not be an auction. And so we want to see what happens here. So, I mean, great wailing and gnashing of teeth. I mean, or celebrations and high fives, depending on your point of view.
A lot of upset people about this.
So you're going more with the wailing and gnashing of teeth.
I think the case is sui generis. I don't think it's going to happen again. I think the bankruptcy judge was getting even. That's what I think. Well, 363 sales have gotten more and more compressed. It used to be, you know, 3, 4, 6 months you'd market the thing before they'd let you sell it. Oh, frankly, let's go back to when we were kids. It wasn't even clear you could sell in 363 without doing a plan at the same time. You know, that was
brand. Well, it's clear that we didn't understand what Lionel meant. Right. Yeah. GM taught us that and Chrysler taught us that.
Yeah, that's right. So it's gotten the sales have gotten shorter and shorter in time. And now you got somebody coming in saying, not only are we going to auction it in 2 weeks, we're not even going to have an auction, we're just going to sell it, period, end of story. And the judges don't like this.
You're saying they overplayed their hand.
Yeah, they stretched the rubber band too far and it snapped back and hit them right in the face.
So you think it's one off? The judge was just ticked off.
I think they're sending a message, don't mess with us because it's going to be painful.
Well, here's my counter to that. That would be fine if the judge had said, this is bullshit. We're not doing this. All right. If the judge had just said no.
Well, this is a Delaware judge. You could say that on the bench in Baton Rouge.
But let's say in chambers. And they are much, much more dignified than I am. But it's one thing to say that. We're not doing this. I want an auction. And it's another thing to say, by the way, 363 carves out from your right to credit bid if your lien is in dispute, if there's a bona fide dispute. If that was what the court did and said that cause is established here with an evidentiary record that would have some evidence in it, that the non-collateral property is of a material value and the credit bid will chill the bidding on that property, which you don't have the right to credit bid on. That, to me, is the right thing to do. But when you have blanket statements that the court found that the credit bid would chill the competitive bidding process, and there won't be an auction because the other party says, if you don't do it my way, I'm not going to play. Well, that's an absolute open door to a much broader problem than we want it done in 3 weeks.
That's a problem?
Why do I think that's a problem? Here's what let's do. You come in and tell me you're willing to bid, but if the other side credit bids higher than you want them to, you won't. Okay, well, then you've established that the credit bid chills the bidding process in connection with the evidence in front of you. Why isn't that going to happen in every single case? It will.
Well, it depends on the facts, right? Because it's not costless to prepare to make a bid of potentially up to like $143 million. Well, I mean, you have to go through your due diligence. It's going to take a lot to go through that. If you know that the amount that the lender could credit bid is more than you would ever spend, you're not going to incur those costs because they're playing with funny money, right? You can't win, right? And so, and if they could have gone to 168 in the winning bid, I think it was 143, they're simply not going to play. And so, that's going to be interesting.
You're making my case because without the circumstances of non-collateral property, then your 168 is bigger than 143.
But it doesn't go to anybody.
Situation, then the size of the bid makes no never mind. Mm-hmm. And in fact, every time judges start doing economics, it's really ugly. But to foster a competitive bidding environment, what the hell does that mean? Yeah. I mean,
well,
without the non-collateral property component, you know, I think this is a bad case.
Yeah,
but with it makes some sense.
There's something else, too. There's stuff coming out in the record now. It wasn't there at the time these decisions were made, and I'm wondering if some of this stuff was conveyed to the bankruptcy judge in chambers before he ruled on credit bidding. It has recently, and I mean within the last, you know, week to 10 days, been alleged by somebody in the case, I forget whether it was a successful buyer or the creditors committee, that this person, you know, the hybrid people who bought the government claim of $168 million, when the government was auctioning that claim, they were up to some no good trying to restrain bidding for the government at the government auction. Ergo, I'm thinking this is just a case of a bankruptcy judge getting even for reasons that are not laid out on the record. It's not going to be a reported opinion, I don't believe. I think it's just a one-off.
But it's going to be cited in every opposition to credit bid in the United States.
Every single opposition is going to quote as to ensure the success of the reorganization or to foster a competitive bidding environment.
Yeah, well, tell you what, let's go on and do preferences in the Third Circuit. Friedman, professor.
Okay, this is a great case. It's the he's talking about the Friedman case, which was decided on Christmas Eve. I didn't know Article III judges had to work on Christmas Eve, but anyway, 738 F 3rd 547. Fascinating case. I'm still trying to decide if I think it came out the right way. I certainly got a good exam question for next year. Here's basically what it has to do with the new value defense in preferences, and the question of whether when you provide the new value, were you paid for that new value? Okay. Obviously, if you get paid a preference, then you supply some more goods on credit or services, whatever, on credit, then if you subsequently get paid for that by an unavoidable transfer, right, you don't get to count the new value because, well, what happened in this case? Guess when the new value, which was indisputably given, guess when that got paid? It got paid just after the petition pursuant to basically like a critical vendor order type thing. It's called a wage order. So the legal question on which there are a fair number of opinions, this may be the First Circuit opinion, and they're pretty much evenly split is, well, do you or do you not count the post-petition payment of the new value that was given pre-petition to negate that as being able to lower the amount of your preference or not, right? Third Circuit said, happy days for you, preference defendant. Doesn't have to count. Now, so if you'd gotten paid, for example, let's say you got paid, so you get paid a preference, then you supply the new value, okay? And then let's say 3 days before the petition, you get paid for that in the ordinary course of business, so it's not going to be recoverable, okay? Well, you lose your new value defense, right? Because you got paid in an unavoidable transfer for the new value. But if, you know, instead they don't quite get around to paying you 3 days before the petition, instead they pay you 2 days after the petition pursuant to a wage order or whatever, you're good to go. And the Third Circuit said, that's right, doesn't count to negate your defense. And that's the slight majority view, it appears, out there. And the court looked at a lot of issues, said, well, you got to cut it off at some point. The statute is not outcome determined. It doesn't specifically clear it up. In my heart of hearts, I feel like somehow that seems wrong, that depending whether you got paid like the day before, the day after the petition.
What I like about this decision is, unlike so many decisions we read now, this case does not try to decide a difficult case by teasing the result out of a statute that was clearly not meant to address this particular situation. What you had was Circuit Judge Rendell instead sat there and said, what is the context in the bankruptcy code of this circumstance, and what is the preference, or what is the purpose of preference law? And Lord of mercy, I think that's the way judges are supposed to decide cases, rather than looking at a statute and finding out whether there's a comma in a particularly important place.
Yeah. I should also just note, there are also a number of cases, they come up this way. They also come up if the supplier gets paid under 503B9, okay? So like, you know, for having supplied just before the petition, the number of cases that way, and most of those come out the same way the Third Circuit did here.
Yeah. By the way, there's a for those of you in a plain meaning case, there is a paragraph or two in the opinion which is really neat. The judge said that just because courts reach different conclusions on a statute does not mean it's ambiguous. I find that absolutely astonishing. But what it means is that if you're in a case and you want to argue a plain meaning against some other court that reached the opposite result with plain meaning, you cite this opinion to say it's not ipso facto.
So it overrules Doosnip. One of the cases that is cited as being wrong is a case I wrote. And they quoted some very scintillating language out of the case, which I thought was pretty damn good. But in the line of cases that the court rejects includes MMR Holding Corporation, and this will teach me to keep my mouth shut. This is a case where the parties agreed there was a preference. It was just a matter of new value, and it was a post-petition. Does that apply? Well, what I found was, notwithstanding the stipulation that there was a preference, there wasn't a preference because the contract under which the payments were made was an assumed contract under 365. But then I had to go off and say, well, if it hadn't been, then it probably would have.
That'll teach you.
Yeah, that'll teach me. But my language was the transferee would be receiving a double use of the new value once as consideration for the unavoidable transfer, which affects a dollar-for-dollar reduction, and once as an offset to the prior preference, which would also reflect a dollar-for-dollar reduction.
Which is clearly true.
And it's clearly true. And the other thing I'll point out, and I'm not going to really – it's really hard – 547C4 does not have any temporal limitation, and it simply says that if the transfer, that if the new value is not paid, did not make an otherwise unavoidable transfer to or for the benefit of such a creditor on account of that new value. And clearly, you know, the argument on the other side is that the critical vendor order is an otherwise unavoidable transfer.
But the concern the court have was similar to what you're talking about, the assumed contract case. They said, well, it would be silly, sort of there was no point in doing the critical vendor order on this because you end up in the same place. I mean, if we then use that to expand the amount of the preference again, it didn't do you any good. I mean, you got paid for this one, but then that jacks back up your liability on the prior one, so it was a futile act.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, I have argued that my case was dicta. Yeah. My language was dicta. And in a case that I had where someone was saying, hey, by the way, you paid all these loggers in a paper mill case, but they got preferences, and I said, no, you can't. You can't count post-petition. They say, well, you remember this opinion? It's a dicta.
You really should.
Yeah.
You know, this reminds me of my favorite movie, Animal House. Remember when Bluto is getting revved up to have a toga party? And he says, he's not going to quit now. And he says, remember when the Germans invaded Pearl Harbor? And one of the smarter guys says, no, you mean the Japanese. They said, don't stop him now. He's on a roll. Well, Lou's on a roll. So, Lou, let's go on to Majestic Star and Subchapter S. And I got to tell you, this is an opinion from the Third Circuit that made my head hurt.
Yeah, it really does make your head
hurt. It's a really thick opinion.
It's a thick opinion, and it's what
we were fighting over who got assigned this one. None of us wanted it. So.
Yeah, you see who's got the stroke. The opinion is about the following. And it's if we had a – I don't know how to do this kind of stuff, so just watch. Barden owns BDI, which is a sub-S corporation, and BDI owns a corporation that owns Majestic Star Casino and another casino. So the corporation that is owned by BDI is a sub-S, a Q-sub, because BDI is a sub-S and is solely owned by Barden. And so the point of all the structure is that there is no taxation at any corporate level. Everything flows through back to the individual because of the sub-S election of the parent corporation. That is done by direction of the shareholders. And everybody here knows way more than I do about sub-S stuff, but what happens is a corporation is not taxed, but the corporation issues dividends or distributions to the owner of the corporation to pay the income tax generated at the corporate level that flows down to the owner. Well, here, Magic Star Casino and the assets got in trouble, and so the Q-sub files bankruptcy. So Barden apparently says, well, that didn't work, so I'm out. He doesn't do anything with respect to, there's no indication in the opinion that he took any action in the bankruptcy case. And pretty shortly after bankruptcy, the sub-S designation or election of BDI is revoked. Barden revokes it. He causes it to be revoked. I'm a solely owner of the parent corporation, which is not in bankruptcy. I revoke the sub-S election. Which turns the Q-sub from a Q-sub to a C-corp. They don't know about this kind of stuff. They're thinking, they're going along saying, well, Barden's paying all the income tax. We don't have to worry about anything. And they get a plan confirmed that they also aren't worried much about because they think that the $117 million of tax liability generated by the sale or the confirmation of the plan is going to flow down to good old Barden. Well, what they find out is that Barden revoked the sub-S, you know, a year ago, and the effective date of the plan is in the next year, and the effective date of the plan converts a C-corp to an LLC, and there's tax stuff everywhere, including on the income made subsequent to the effective date of the revocation of the sub-S election. So the debtor and the creditors and everybody goes crazy, and sues to revoke, and the bankruptcy judge revokes the revocation and orders the corporation to be, the election to be reinstated at the parent level, and therefore the Q-sub status to be reinstated until confirmation of the plan, meaning that Barden pays all kinds of income tax, and that's a great way to do a reorganization. and so what the underlying thought at the bankruptcy court level was that we were dealing, the court was dealing with essentially a stay violation and or avoidable 549 transfer because we were talking about a sub-S status being property of the estate.
Because it has value.
Because it has value.
We pause this program for your online CLE codes. Please write down 3, 2, 7, 9, 6. Thank you.
And what the Third Circuit said is no. The sub-S status is not property of the debtor estate. It's property of the parent, but it is subject to the control of the ultimate shareholder, Barden. The sub-S election of the Q-sub status is subject to the sub-S election of the parent, which is subject to the desires of the shareholder, basically. And the court says, nice try, But the value is only value to the extent that you can move tax liability to the owner. But that's why the owner has sole discretion to revoke the sub S election. The court attempted to distinguish, and this is what makes my head hurt, because the court attempted to distinguish the NOL cases.
Yeah.
And in all Chapter 11 cases that have a lot of shareholders, the C corp or even the NOL cases involve corporations that show net operating losses that they can carry back or they can carry forward.
Right.
That's a corporate right. The sub S or the LLC taxes, a partnership, losses stay at the owner level, and they're only utilized in the owner's tax return through the partnership or the LLC tax returns that are in Schedule C that show all the income that or loss that flows through. But what the court here says is that the sub S designation is not property of the estate. And I don't even think that if the parent was in bankruptcy, it would have said that it's the property of the parent's estate because it lodges the right at the shareholder, ultimate shareholder level, which is Barton.
By the way, there's some important stuff in here for you tax mavens. Back when I was... I guess I was in college at the time. There was a little case on who owns or whether tax loss carrybacks are property of the bankrupt estate.
I was going to ask you about that case.
Yeah, it was the first time I was in the U.S. Supreme Court. I watched my father argue it. The case was called Siegel versus Rochelle, and he won it, thank goodness, held that tax loss carrybacks are property of the estate. Subsequent to that, the Second Circuit ruled that tax loss carry forwards are property of the estate. This Majestic Star opinion from the Third Circuit is important because there is language in it which could be interpreted to mean they will disagree with the Second Circuit and hold that tax loss carry forwards are not property of the estate. Yeah. And it may well be that that could be just about the most important part of that
and the thing that makes my head hurt about it, I understand what the Third Circuit says. I've wondered about the NOL cases because, you know, you can lose your NOL. It's a corporate property right. But if you have an ownership, control change, the NOL goes away, carry back or carry forward. It goes away. And there are measures by which you can preserve the NOL to some extent, and there are measures by which you can do a reorganization through the bankruptcy code and have qualified creditors be the equity holders coming out and preserve the NOL. And that got me to thinking about whether the Third Circuit had thought about the fact that you can terminate equity if there's not a solvent corporate debtor and reissue it and maybe not trigger, have a trigger event that terminates the sub-S, but I'm not sure that the sub-S rules would allow you to substitute a new owner in a sub-S situation where the NOL does.
Well, and there are definitely cases that go the other way than this. I think this is going to continue to percolate up through the courts.
Yeah, and it's unintelligible. It's really... really difficult stuff. Let's go on to Alan Gropper, bankruptcy judge in New York, who come, I think it's October, will be retiring after a full 14 years term on the bench. He decided a case against Kerr McGee in favor of Tronox, which was in Chapter 11. This little case could cost Kerr McGee anywhere between $5 and $14 billion. They are thinking these days that Judge Gropper should have retired about a year earlier before he wrote this decision, because Alan Gropper basically found them with their pants down. He held that Kerr McGee committed a bald-faced fraudulent transfer with actual intent to hinder and delay creditors. Here's how they did it. Kerr McGee had basically a bunch of legacy companies many of whom were, I'll call them, dirty, because they had enormous environmental liabilities as well as post-employment liabilities. Kerr McGee was, let's call it, unmarketable in the sense that nobody would buy Kerr McGee because it had these legacy liabilities. They got real smart back in the mid-2000s, so they spun off all of the dirty stuff that had the liabilities to the company called Tronox, and then all the clean stuff came with stayed with Kerr McGee. And guess what happened about 3 months after the spinoff? Somebody, named that somebody was Anadarko, made an enormously huge multi-billion dollar purchase of the clean Kerr McGee. Well, as you can guess, dear old Tronox ends up in bankruptcy about 2 years after the spinoff, and the creditors, after confirmation of the plan and the creation of a trust, sue or continue a suit based on a fraudulent transfer with actual intent, and basically Alan Gropper just undressed them seven ways from Sunday. He said that this was a fraudulent transfer by clear and convincing evidence, as I said, with actual intent to hinder and delay creditors. He said that the Kerr McGee people wholly failed to rebut the evidence about the fraudulent transfer. This is a remarkable opinion because most often courts tend to immunize people on some theory or another from such enormous liability flowing from what are basically typical corporate transactions. Judge Gropper said some other things in this opinion beyond the fraudulent transfer stuff, which I think is really quite important. One of them has to do with Stern versus Marshall. This lawsuit began long before Stern versus Marshall was decided. There could have been a very a strenuous Stern versus Marshall effort to get the case out of bankruptcy court, but guess what? They blew it. They didn't make that objection. And Alan Gropper said that, number one, you're too late. And number two, he pointed out that Kerr McGee had filed a multi-billion dollar claim in the bankruptcy case.
That was really smart.
And therefore, yeah, oops. Right. And so therefore, they do not have any Stern versus Marshall rights. There was also an argument that the spinoff itself back in 2007 was immunized from fraudulent transfer liability by the safe harbor in Section 546E of the Bankruptcy Code. Gropper again said, too bad, guys, you waived this argument by not making it until many years into the case. And further, he said, there were no transfers of securities. And because there were none, that means that the safe harbor does not apply. One of my takeaways from this opinion is this is a case in which these really smart lawyers for Kerr McGee blew it, because had they incorporated some securities transfers into the spinoff transactions years before, then they might well have gotten themselves off the hook, because if you know, the Second Circuit is rabid about the expansive protection of 546E safe harbors.
It'll be interesting to see what happens there in the Madoff case was just argued.
I'm afraid it's going to be a loser. The Madoff safe harbor case was argued about a week ago, yeah. And it was not pretty.
But wasn't there? Isn't help me out here, because I get spun around on 546E and all the statutes you have, all the sections you have to bring in. But isn't there in the Bear Stearns case involved a kind of a margin payment Ponzi scheme? And at the initial summary judgment hearing, the court found that there was actual fraud in the transaction, and therefore the securities margin payment exception didn't apply. Here, you did have a finding of actual fraud, and so I think the securities exception would be problematic given that fact finding.
So long as it occurred within 2 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's talk about Detroit. I believe, Professor, that's yours.
It is. I just want to show you, I actually printed out the whole case, so my suitcase going back will be a lot lighter. We just want to flag for you, I mean, obviously we've only got about 15 minutes left, and probably most of you have heard that Judge Rhodes did in fact find that Detroit was eligible for Chapter 9 in a very, very long opinion. Obviously, the interest many interesting things about that. I mean, one now wonders, of course, wonder what will happen in the Sixth Circuit, certainly in terms of that. If you look through the opinion, I don't see a high likelihood of that getting overturned. Certainly looks bad. I think it's a fascinating question in terms of the intersection of, you know, you have the Michigan law that constitutionally says the pensions are sacrosanct, and then but we can't get rid of them. The federal government can't get rid of them because of the 10th Amendment, and so we have Chapter 9, so you just kind of pass it back and forth, and we can stick it to the pensioners. So I think a lot of municipalities all over the country are going to be looking at this. I think also there'll be an interesting question whether they try and redefine pensions as the pension obligations as property rights. A lot of discussion about that, that the problem is that they're set up as contractual liabilities. That makes them subject to discharge in the bankruptcy if you go the Chapter 9 route, which people are certainly looking at doing. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yep, going to direct appeal. By the way, very interesting. There's controversy over whether to allow a direct appeal or any appeal at all. The bankruptcy judge Rhodes recommended against it. Mm-hmm. The circuit court did allow a
but
direct
appeal. But they didn't
expedite it. But, yeah, they said, but, well, you know.
We'll get to it eventually.
We're going to get to this. It's
a tough confirmation hearing with eligibility hanging over your head.
Yeah. Well, what they're trying to do is bang these people's heads together and make them settle.
One interesting just sort of overall fact about the case, of course, was, and I think one, aside from the fact that the city of Detroit's trying to slash the pensions, but the offer that was sort of put on the table prior to filing Chapter 9 by Orr, I don't think a lot of people took that as a spirit of this is a really fair and balanced offer that's really open to negotiation. Sort of a put-up job, but we'll see what happens.
Well, let's go on to the Fifth Circuit, your sister predecessor circuit here, with Texas Grand Prairie. Lou, tell us about it.
Yeah, Texas Grand Prairie is an interest rate case out of the Fifth Circuit, and it's generated some really interesting practice amongst bankruptcy judges in the Fifth Circuit about cram-down interest rates, and I think represents a real circuit court departure that I have used even before it came out because I couldn't do anything else. The lower courts utilized a TIL approach, and the TIL approach that was utilized focused solely on the factors enumerated in TIL. And anybody that knows anything, and all of you do, about interest rates and cram-down interest rates knows that you can find a case that says anything, and a whole lot of them talk about the factors that you use to decide the risk and the whatever, whatever, whatever. And I see there's some really big words in some of the ABI materials here that's going to be discussed in business issues. But you know, I was in a little case, and the judge says, well, you have to go to the market to get some of the criteria for determining what the interest rate is. I said, no, I don't. I'm not going to the market because I have a broke debtor and I have a broke owner of a broke debtor who's in an individual Chapter 11, and I'm paying 100 cents on the dollar, so my loan to value is 90% value to 100% loan, so it's 110%, I'm underwater, and I can't meet any of the covenants. And so you got to decide, Judge, do you throw me out or do you utilize a TIL approach that focuses on the nature of the assets, the nature of the performance in Chapter 11, whether the performance is increasing, whether the interest rate starts at the right place and provides a sufficient risk premium, and whether the reporting requirements that I'm going to make post-confirmation are sufficient to substitute for market loan covenants. Because if you ever go to the market, you stay in the market. There's just no way around it. And the judge bought it, and here Grand Prairie says, we're going to approve that approach, and we're going to point out that Till rejected the coerced loan approach, which requires a trip into the market. And then you have experts who say, I'm an expert at coming up with a fake market. Well, what kind of expert is that? I'm a fake expert because I'm dealing with a fake market. And in my case, the guy on the other side of me was correct, except he was wrong too. He testified that a loan, if it would be made, would require a 19.9% interest rate. And that was right, except he was wrong. There would never be a loan made, even at 19.9% interest rate. So the courts in the Fifth Circuit have taken this. The other very important point, which I think is really important, the Fifth Circuit said that the fixing of the approach and the fixing of the rate is a question of fact, reviewable for clear error. And that is a really big deal because the argument was you're choosing a methodology which is a question of law, and the court said no. And that to me is a really important thing. So what the Fifth Circuit judges said, now the court went on to say, we're not saying the Till controls or is even the optimum rate. Mm-hmm. And I promise you the bankruptcy judge in the Fifth Circuit don't read that part. Yeah. What they're reading is we're not going to get reversed. Yeah. And the court said, pointed out that Till says 1-3 over prime. And what the next cases that are reported out of the Fifth Circuit aren't even using experts on interest rate. Why? Because there's no such thing as an expert on a fake interest rate. You an expert on the nature of the business, the nature of the collateral, is it depreciating, what's the rate of depreciation, the cash flow approach, the cash flow analysis, the historical versus what's been happening in bankruptcy, and get the guy on the stand in the smaller case and say, I'm going to work my ass off 20 hours a day because I love this property. Yeah, they're all going to be broke. So you're never going to get a solvent guarantor. You're never going to get an 80-20 loan-to-value. You're never going to get any of that stuff. But if you can focus on the analysis that the Fifth Circuit approved or affirmed, you don't have to go through all that interest
rate. Well, listen, tell you what. You all here are in the 11th Circuit. And here's how you can do a tap dance around Texas Grand Prairie if you need to. In that case, the parties had stipulated that the Till decision from the Supreme Court dealing with Chapter 13 interest rates would be applicable in Chapter 11. Higginbotham said in part that, well, no, that's, you know, that doesn't have to be the methodology you use. What you can do if you are confronted by Till is you can simply say that because it was stipulated that Till applied in Texas Grand Prairie, the remainder and the most important part of Higginbotham's decision in Texas Grand Prairie is pure dicta. Pure dicta, because he talks about all the other methodologies, what's right, what's wrong, pure dicta. So keep that in mind.
I'll beat you on that, because what he says is that unless you can find as a matter of fact that there is an efficient market, you got to pick another way of doing it, and one thing you can't pick is the forced or coerced hypothetical loan analysis, because Till threw that out.
Lou, you're on a roll again. Let's continue with you on Castleton Seventh Circuit expansion of Radlax.
New value exception here. Plan says the state, I think it was Illinois, but I'm not sure. It was a Seventh Circuit state that was not a community property state. Wife is going to purchase equity in solely owned corporation owned by husband. Creditor says wife's going to pay $75,000, and the new value exception is not applicable, says debtor. Absolute priority rule is not applicable, says debtor, because husband, sole owner, is not retaining any property on account of his interest. The Seventh Circuit, the bankruptcy court says, I agree, that's fine. Seventh Circuit says, no, an insider proposing equity is tantamount to the debtor owner proposing equity. So we're going to treat the insider as the owner for purposes of the absolute priority rule, and the absolute priority rule requires under LaSalle competitive bidding, And here, I mean, you know, bad facts make, you know, okay law, I think. but here the wife wanted to put up 75 grand. The creditor says, I'll pay 600 and pay 100 cents on the dollar to all the unsecured creditors. And the plan called for a 75,000 equity purchase plus 15 cents on the dollar over 5 years. I don't know how the hell the plan got confirmed, but it did. And the bankruptcy, somehow there was no equitable mootness on appeal. The district court, I think, reversed, but the Seventh Circuit may have gotten it directly. I don't know. But the Seventh Circuit throws it out, remands for further proceedings, but says that the insider contribution has to be made subject to competitive bidding. Also says that the creditor who bids can bid its claim.
Yeah. Well, the case, I think, is actually pretty simple. If the Seventh Circuit is followed by everybody else, it means, frankly, that whenever a secured creditor wants to credit bid, whatever the circumstance, it's going to happen. That's all there is to it. Can't cut off the right to credit bid. Let's stay in the Fifth Circuit. Let's do a Village at Camp Bowie, a decision just about a year ago, bankruptcy decision by the estimable Mike Lynn. Direct appeal to the circuit court, affirmed by Judge Higginbotham, who writes a very fine opinion on bankruptcy. This is a case which holds that so-called artificial impairment is perfectly okie-dokie, at least in the Fifth Circuit, when you structure a plan and you have, say, perhaps only one class that's going to vote no, so you artificially impair another class who will obediently vote yes. The Fifth Circuit is lined up with the Ninth Circuit in approving artificial impairment. The Eighth Circuit is on the other side of the fence. They disapprove of artificial impairment. I suppose this case sometime in the next 5 years will go to the U.S. Supreme Court, seeing as how they're taking two or three cases every year on bankruptcy.
This was really artificial impairment, too.
Yeah,
$59,000 worth of unsecured claims paid in full in 3 monthly payments.
Exactly right.
90 days. But that's impairment.
And the secured claim.
The actual impairment was $900.
Yeah.
The secured claim that was going to vote no was $32 million.
Yeah. And did vote no. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was going to and did.
Yeah.
And said it looked like that not only the tail wagging the dog, but the tip of the tail wagging the tip, wagging the tail that was wagging the dog.
Well, Mike Lynn threw a little bit of a bone to the secured lender. The plan provided for an interest rate on this crammed down restructured mortgage of 5.8%. Mike said, no, that's not enough. He raised it to 6.4%, an increase of about 0.6%. What is significant about this opinion is that Higginbotham said that the ability to pay the claims in full on artificial impairment is a good faith issue.
Yeah.
But, bless his heart, Mike Lynn found that the plan was proposed in good faith, and as a consequence, what would seem to some perhaps to be not really a finding of fact becomes a finding of fact, which means that in the Fifth Circuit, if you have a sympathetic bankruptcy judge, you will be able to use
discretionary impairment.
Yeah. Yes.
And Bill, don't you think the Supreme Court would affirm this? I mean, the way the statute read there, they just said impairment's impairment.
All right. But I want to talk about one more case. It is impairment. Yeah. I want to talk about one more case because it shows that I live and have to work in a schizophrenic circuit. The White Transportation case involves right next to Village at Camp Bowie, which is a plain meaning. You're importing gloss on the statute. In White Transportation, the plan says, the schedules say, lien is disputed, claim is disputed. Litigation for years before the bankruptcy case. Chapter 11, plan says your lien is no good. It's first. You get no money. Inferior liens get paid in accordance with the plan. You're mean. I don't like you. This lien is no good. Did I make myself clear? Creditor doesn't file proof of claim. doesn't object to plan, doesn't
stays
vote
away.
No, says, I'm treating you like a vampire, go away. And plan is confirmed. Order of confirmation says lien is no good, you get no money, inferior liens get paid, and creditor then brings an action to determine that its lien is valid. Fifth Circuit says, yes, lien is valid because one of the criteria or conditions for affecting liens and interests is that the holder of the lien and interest must actively participate in the bankruptcy case because of the rule, paren, created in the Fifth Circuit over dinner, close paren, is that if you have a lien, you don't have to play. You can look to your lien for enforcement and for recovery regardless of the bankruptcy process. So Fifth Circuit on one hand says discretionary impairment is fine because there's nothing in the statute that says, and on the other hand reads out 1141 because it says this rule is going to apply because there's no statutory provision contrary to it.
Well, further,
because they don't read the one that is.
I also believe that opinion is just dead wrong in view of Espinosa.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, the
they didn't appeal confirmation, right? You don't appeal confirmation. They came in with a separate adversary declaring that their lien, seeking a declaratory judgment that their lien was unaffected and was still valid and primed the inferior liens
and
contravened the plan.
Espinosa should have been the most important part of the decision. They relegated it to one footnote.
Well, it doesn't apply in the Fifth Circuit if you're dealing with secured creditors holding liens on property that you affect only through the plan. Now, the problem is that if the creditor says, I'm not participating, how do you get participation? Well, I'm going to object to your claim, but you're objecting to my claim to make me participate. So I'm not going to participate in the objection to claim process. Well, I'm going to file a Rule 3012 motion to value your collateral. I'm going to file an adversary proceeding to determine the rank, extent, validity, and priority of your lien. I decline. Now, it takes guts, but this creditor had plenty of guts because it was looking at plans that not hidden, discharged. Don't read this plan because it's look over here. Big, bold letters. Your lien is no good and you will never get a penny. Fine.
We pause this program for your online CLE codes. Please write down 19732. Thank you.
Well, maybe if Lou comes back in next year for this show, he'll have a decision on whether or not this Y Transportation case was correct or not. I'm not sure where he comes down, having heard him talk.
I thought I was clear. Anyway, thanks a lot. I really appreciate being here.